The fight for women's rights has been around for a very long time. We're going to talk about some of the people that were and are involved in that struggle. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network today. Our next guest is the author of a new graphic novel. Mickey Kendall is a writer, historian, and diversity consultant. And her latest book, a graphic novel, is called Amazons, Abolitionists, and Activists, a graphic history of women's fight for their rights. Have you found it difficult to learn about women in history? What are your thoughts on graphic novels? Well, join the discussion, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mickey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Now, this is an extremely interesting book. Why did you decide to write it as a graphic novel?
A fun fact is that a lot of people who think they don't like reading really don't like wall of text reading.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And people are sometimes convinced that they're not good readers or they're not good learners because they're not good readers. Well, you just have a different learning style. And one of the things I wanted to do was make history fun and accessible, because even if you're not great at reading a giant block of black text on white paper, a lot of us really enjoy comics. We enjoy graphic novels. We learn a lot from them if they are presented to us with good content.
Right.
And I have a lot of feelings and opinions, as you maybe tell.
Oh, as you should.
About people insisting that graphic novels aren't worth reading.
Oh,
so
no.
I wanted to sort of counter that narrative and put something out that would be informative but also fun and engaging, and people would want to come back and look at it again and again.
Now, who was your audience when you started this project?
It was a nebulous, probably over 12, but maybe as young as 10, all the way to 90, sort of a range.
Okay.
It was an all-ages book.
Sure, sure. Well, I know I'm certainly well over 12, and there were a lot of things in there that I had absolutely no clue of, had never heard of before. It's very interesting to anybody, and it's a fairly quick read. But like you said, you can go back through it a lot and keep looking at things, and the artwork is amazing. Talk about the illustrations and who did those for the book.
So Aide D'Amico, who is the illustrator, I worked with them on a Spitball comics anthology, a 5-page story. And it was such a pleasant process, you know, completely easy to communicate, beautiful artwork. So when this came up, I said, well, would you have time? And A said, yes. And so we did the original sketches, and 10 Speed kind of came back and said, okay, so we need to just make a plan for the year. You know, how are we going to do this? Deadline dates. And we have a separate colorist. But one of the things that we agreed on was that we wanted the book to be something people wanted to look at.
Right.
Right. Sometimes people don't, even people who like comics, who like graphic novels and that kind of thing, will not pick up a book because they don't like the artwork.
Sure. Understandable.
And I wanted it to be something where people would be like, oh, I really like that image on page 37. Or, you know, I want to show someone the really great detail on this. And Aide D'Amico agreed and said, you know, I really want to sort of branch out and use a lot of different techniques, a lot of different things from the time. So we were basically simpatico the entire way about what we wanted it to look like. We knew we wanted it to be something that would catch the eye and then keep your attention.
And the colors are beautiful. They're rich. They're muted in some cases. So you get that kind of history feel. But yeah, they're very dynamic. So you guys did a wonderful, wonderful job with that. Now, you've written graphic novels before, correct?
I've written comics.
Comics. Okay. And so what is the difference? What's the difference?
It's really just a length question.
Okay, okay.
Comics are 22 to 25 pages. This was my first big 189 pages.
Mm-hmm. It's big. It's definitely
big.
So what are some of the challenges when you're writing in that kind of format? Because you have to be pretty succinct.
So one of the things is I'm not necessarily the world's best outliner. I have a vague idea of where I'm going from A to B.
Okay.
In between, sometimes I have to go back. And so one of the things was just being organized and then keeping it organized so that the narrative flows throughout, because there's certain points in history where you have to reference things that happened earlier mm-hmm. in order to explain what is happening now.
Right.
And so it's kind of at first a messy jumble, almost like a spider web to figure out this goes mm-hmm. from here to here. One second.
Okay. Well, we're talking.
Oh, no, that's fine.
You're good. Yeah, okay. Well, okay. I can just tell everybody that we are talking with Mickey Kendall about her new book. It's a graphic novel called Amazon's Abolitionists and Activists, a graphic history of women's fight for their rights. So you were talking about your process, Mickey.
Yes. Sorry. I neighbor at the door and was like,
never. She's on a phone, folks.
Yes. So, sorry.
That's okay. Go right ahead.
And so, you know, the whole thing was sort of trying to map it out and figure out what was important in each time frame.
Right.
But also, because there's just no way to put in everyone.
Right.
Also recognizing and explaining at times, because I knew some of my readers would be younger, that this isn't everything. It's fine for you to know that this is not everything. I want people to look at it and think about the folks they feel like are missing and go look for those people and go see how those people connect to what we chose.
Right. Great. Where did the idea of putting this book together come from? Was that your?
It was a collaborative thing. Alex DeCampi, who was another comics writer, they had mentioned something to Alex. And Alex says, I know the perfect person for that project you think you might want, emailed me. I came up with a pitch that was not technically exactly what they were looking for, but my pitch won anyway. And then from there, it sort of morphed into this because, you know, when you start a project like this, you don't totally know what your end result is going to be. You have a vague direction you want it to go in. You know that you want to cover certain things, but you don't really know. It's like making a cake for the first time.
Sure.
You don't really know what the final product is going to look like mm-hmm. until you're getting closer to the end.
Well, why don't you tell us the actual premise of the book? How do you tell the story?
So the actual premise of the book is that a group of students has a project assigned to them about the history of women's fight for their rights, and they start arguing with each other, and they're taking a class with an AI who we internally called Guide. So Guide gets tired of listening to them argue and takes them via a little bit of time travel through various important points, both in art history mm-hmm. and in history itself. And I use the art history component because that made it easier for a visual book.
Yes.
And so Guide, that's why there's, you know, they're in the gallery at the beginning, and Guide is showing them the different Venuses and things like that, the cave paintings, so that they understand that this is not this one event is all of women's fight for their rights. There are multiple events across time and in multiple places, because we tend to teach history sometimes through the lens of one country or one set of countries,
yes.
instead of talking about what's happening around the world at that moment.
Mm-hmm. I think we've all experienced that when we've been through history classes where it is kind of just focused. And then later on, you get exposed to others. And you're like, well, why wasn't I told this when I, you know, did learn the history? So is this kind of a response to that type of learning?
Yes, because one of the things, I was a person who thought I didn't like history. I thought I absolutely loathed history classes until I was in my freshman year of college. I took a class with the professor, Kevin Hale, and he tied things together. And I loved that class. I had such a good time. It made me think, I've never taken a class that was fun in history.
Yes.
And it wasn't just the dates. You know how sometimes in history classes, we all learn that the Battle of Hastings was 1066, for instance. We don't know why we know that. We have no idea why we remember the Battle of Hastings.
Mm-hmm. Or who invented the cotton gin, right? Because that was always a biggie.
I actually remember Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin.
Yeah, so me too.
If I remember anything else around the cotton gin. Right? And so that was one of the things. I said, well, you know, if history is like this now, why wasn't it like this when I was a kid? I would have paid attention, because to some degree you end up sort of rote memorizing certain things, and then in your head history is just a set of dates
mm-hmm.
and things that happened on those dates. There's no people, there's no story of humanity.
Right.
He taught it more as a story of humanity, which is what got me. I actually changed my major as a result of that class, which got me to major in history.
Wow.
And then when I was doing this, one of the things I had noticed, I have two children, their social studies books really aren't that interesting.
Yeah.
Right? And it's always a battle to get them to do this homework and to read these things. And so we would come up and have come up with other things for them to get them more into it. And I started thinking when we were planning this, I wonder if I could make it so that you could have it as a usable textbook, but also something you would enjoy reading anyway.
Sure. Yeah, I could see that for sure. Mm-hmm. Have anybody approached you about using it as a textbook? I know it just came out in November, so it's relatively new on the market.
Yes. There are a couple of districts. I apparently, inadvertently, managed to land in a place where I am suitable for Common Core usage.
Ah. Great.
So there are a couple school districts, one in Massachusetts, and I want to say another one where I know teachers are exploring being able to add it to their curriculum. I've seen a few tweets, too, from individual teachers putting it on their classroom shelves or intending to use it in the Women's History Month curriculum.
Oh, for sure. Oh, that would be perfect for that, because there's just not a lot of resources, more than there used to be. But this would be, like you said, a very accessible one for kids to take a look at. And like you had mentioned before, you had to kind of pick and choose who was going to be included. Did you have a criteria? Did you have how did you make that decision?
I went with a mixture of most notable events and the figures at those events,
mm-hmm.
and in some cases, places where we just really don't talk about it at all. I tried to show that history from different angles. You know, so like we talk about the suffragette movement, but we rarely talk about black suffragettes or mm-hmm. the labor history movement and the women involved in it. We don't really talk about disability or LGBTQIA history in the same way.
Right.
And that was the other thing I wanted to do, was bring it together, that there were women present and working in all of these places, and that those women had a great impact on the rights of women as a whole.
And they're all kind of interrelated, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting way to look at it, too, because we do seem to get these historical facts in chunks, and they don't tie in together. And obviously, you know, life is all interconnected. So that does absolutely make a lot of sense. And you go all the way back to 3000 BCE. That's a long time ago. Why was it important for you to go way back there?
For one, it's a slightly petty thing, but people tend to talk about cavemen.
Yes, they do.
And I had seen this article ages ago talking about the cave paintings and the different Venus statues, the early Venuses, and the realization someone had that the way these fertility figures looked is really the view a woman might have looking down herself.
Oh.
That the cave paintings were made when they looked at them more closely.
Uh-huh.
These are small hands with thin fingers.
Sure, sure.
So that would be women, not men.
Right.
And then the number of things that it turned out, I'm one of the people who reads like Scientific American and some other stuff as a hobby. the number of bodies they had discovered that were supposedly burials of men that they were now figuring out. Oh, they were buried with weapons, so we said they were men, but actually they were women.
Yeah.
The whole time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a little bit of a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about a few of the people that you have in the book. We're talking with Mickey Kendall. Her new book is called Amazons, Abolitionists, and Activists, A Graphic History of Women's Fight for Their Rights. What questions do you have about women in history? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. We're talking about the history of the fight for women's rights. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Mickey Kendall. She is a writer, historian, and diversity consultant. Her latest book is Amazon's Abolitionists and Activists, a graphic history of women's fight for their rights. When you think about the struggle for women's rights, what historical figures do you think of? Well, we'd like to hear your thoughts. Contact us by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mickey, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, we were talking a little bit about the very beginnings of, well, your novel and also of the history that you provided in that. Talk about a few of the women that you highlight in that very first chapter.
Okay, so let's go back to the first chapter is what you're telling me. Let's go.
Yeah, let's go back to the beginning.
All right. Actually, one of the things that would be really interesting to talk about is the pharaoh Hatshepsut and how she proved ancient Egypt was interesting because even though jobs were gendered, women were pretty close to equal in terms of rights. It was only really when you got into ruling that there started to be a, well, men rule and women don't,
right.
Well, women co-rule kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But she declared herself not queen, but pharaoh, and ruled over a golden era in which she was also a warrior. They attempted to erase her from the history books in the aftermath, well, the history obelisks, more accurately.
Right. They literally, yeah, they took the chisel and chiseled off her likeness and name, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that when I first heard about her, I assumed that her rule had been something terrible and lots of people were, you know, suffering, so forth. No. Actually, she is one of the early examples of a pattern of female rulers who were actually pretty good at what they were doing, but they were also hated and then erased. So we then think as you move forward in time, you start to think that very few women ruled. It's not that very few women ruled. It's that very many women who ruled were erased from the history record and then are now being put back as we find that information, as we find that evidence.
Finally, right, because that's so true. We read, again, when we were talking about earlier, our history books, there's not very many women mentioned, maybe Queen Elizabeth I, that's about it. Yeah, so where did you do your research? I mean, where did you find these people?
So I did some was actually technically through Wikipedia, because Wikipedia was a good place to start to find books to use. Wikipedia requires you to have sources at the bottom.
Sure.
So it wasn't a Wikipedia source book exactly, but Wikipedia was a good place to find someone else's bibliography.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a person in mind and I had one or two books and wanted to know what other books were being used, were current, that kind of thing. The library, of course. Oddly enough, Google and Twitter were great places to find tips on people who I might not think of. I would ask, you know, if there was someone local history that you knew that you wish people talked more about, who might that be? And
yeah,
because I have a pretty broad Twitter platform, I would get responses from all over the world. So it would kind of set me off on these little tears to make sure I was covering different places, because you have to know going into doing something like this, whatever history you think you know, you don't know enough of it.
Uh-huh.
And you don't know what someone from the area, someone from that culture might know. So you need to make sure that you're asking other people for the stories that they think are important, because whatever history you've been taught in your country isn't necessarily going to be comprehensive about the world, especially in the U.S.
Oh, yes, definitely, because we see a very narrow view of all these events that happened in history. And I was really surprised at you had mentioned earlier the Egyptian pharaoh Hatshepsut.
Hatshepsut.
Thank you.
Hatshepsut. I always say her name wrong, so don't worry. It's Hatshepsut.
Yeah, I know. But she was a warrior, and there are a lot of women who were fighters. And again, we have no clue that they were even there. What are some of the other ones that stand out to you?
So one of the other things that stood out to me was the fall of Rome. We think of all of Rome falling,
mm-hmm,
and actually all of Rome does not fall. it's part of Rome falls, mm-hmm. right? And so Empress Irene, one of the things that was fascinating to me, she ruled the Byzantine Empire, and 200 years before the Byzantine Empire is really what we would think of it now. She's one of the first, when Rome first falls, she holds together what would have been Eastern Rome and keeps it from falling, and then is deposed, not because her people are suffering, but because she wouldn't go to war with Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. She said, it's a war we can't win. We shouldn't fight it. So she's deposed. King Nikephoros, who is her replacement, his head winds up a drinking cup.
Lovely.
I was like, well, perhaps we should have listened to Empress Irene.
Perhaps they should have. Now, many of the women that you profile, they have beliefs that are, well, I mean, they're kind of biased, okay? So, and you don't shy away from that fact. You know, the people that we thought, you know, wanted this, technically only wanted it for this group of people and not for that group of people. Were you surprised by some of their viewpoints when you were doing this research?
I was a little surprised by Queen Elizabeth, even though I knew she was not exactly a feminist icon.
Mm-hmm.
I was still a little surprised to look at some of the paperwork. You know, she had a lot written during her time.
Mm-hmm.
She was very prolific. And she really didn't think of other women as being the same as her. She really thought of herself as exceptional. And so it was a little weird to see how even the queens that make it through that we've been shown, right? Because we all read about Queen Elizabeth, and depending upon where you learned about history and how you learned, you might think she was the first major woman to ever rule.
Yeah, which she wasn't.
right, and she wasn't. She absolutely mm-hmm. wasn't. You know, you hear about Cleopatra and that kind of thing, but even Cleopatra, we hear a very biased lens that she's, you know, this sexual creature and not
yes.
that she was genuinely incredibly smart
mm-hmm.
and a notable leader. So one of the things that was a little interesting is that you have this split even through the different queens, right? So Queen Siendek of Silla, which would go on to become Korea, she is interested in more women ruling and more women being educated. At the same time, Elizabeth is really only concerned with her success. You have others who set up institutions so that their people can learn, but some who really are in it just for power. It's a really interesting look at the fact that when we say, oh, well, if women ran the world, women are still human.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Can't paint them in black and white like that. That's not right. So, we're talking with Mickey Kendall about her new book, Amazon's Abolitionists and Activists, A Graphic History of Women's Fight for Their Rights. What questions do you have about women in history? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, we can't look at this book without really looking at the suffragists, especially with the 100th, you know, anniversary coming up or passing. It's really, you know, hard to believe that women only got the right to vote in the U.S. 100 years ago. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the beginnings of women's right to get the vote? Where did it get started?
So it actually, even though we tend to give credit in the suffrage movement to Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others, they get the idea from the Haudenosaunee. The Seneca Falls meetings are where they realize that indigenous women have more rights in their communities than white women have in America. And they say, I want the same rights they do, okay,
mm-hmm.
or that they have. And so what then happens, because even when white women get the right to vote, not all women get the right to vote in America, what actually happens is that white women get the right, black women get the right about 45 years later, the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Sure.
You know, some communities of indigenous people don't get the right to vote honored until the 1970s. And so what happens is that they start to realize, and this is an unfortunate part of suffrage that's sort of buried, some white women, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others, Susan B. Anthony is another one, position it as this will protect white supremacy. If white women can vote, we'll be able to outvote black men when they get to vote.
Was that a strategy, or did they truly believe that that was the best way to go?
They truly, apparently, even though that some of them were abolitionists,
mm-hmm.
they truly believed, and they put it in writing. This wasn't a thing that was said once Mm-hmm. It was said over and over again. Rebecca Lattimore Felton, who is most notable for being the first woman to have a Senate seat, even though it was only briefly, she was an advocate for lynching. You had all of these other racial dynamics going on, even within the suffrage movement. And so as women got the right to vote, which is how we tend to frame it, what really happened is white women got the right to vote. And it was not necessarily the best thing for other communities.
Definitely. And that was an eye opener for me because, you know, we've heard about these women and it's always been women. And I just assumed, which is a bad thing to do, that included all women. But it certainly did not do that. Let's go on then to some of the civil rights workers, which, of course, there are so many. How did you, especially because we know them, there's more history now. How did you narrow down who you were going to put in and who you were going to mention?
It was so difficult. And
I can't imagine.
Now admit that this was around this point and the pages where my editor said, okay, we've got a limit.
Yeah. Definitely.
There's only so far we can go with this. And so we've got to start figuring out how many people per page, because the other thing was that A. D'Amico also kept saying 8 panels is a logical page. 9 panels is not. You can't have a 9 panel, 12 panel. Slow down. That's why some of the spreads are so intricate to accommodate the fact that I want to put in absolutely everyone.
Sure.
And that's actually true throughout the book.
Right, and she does a great job of putting all of this information, because some pages do have a lot of information, a lot of people, in smaller bites that it's easy to digest, really. So it doesn't look cluttered. It's very clean, and it's very easy to navigate, I thought.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that, because that was one of the things that we were trying to also do. We wanted the book to be something that regardless of your focus, if it were going to be used in the classroom, used to supplement classroom teaching, that kind of thing, if it was going to be something you were just starting to get interested in and wanted a quick primer as an adult, we wanted it to be a place where as much information as possible was conveyed without it just being giant blocks of text over and over.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that it's really hard sometimes for us to interest boys in anything that says girl or women on it? Do you think that this format is something that will help in that direction?
I have seen quite a few young gentlemen. People have been tweeting pictures at me of their kids with the book.
Oh, sure, sure.
And I've seen quite a few pictures. There are quite a few young men who have been more than happy. They've also come to different events that we've had for this book, signings, that kind of thing. And I think part of why it's working is because it's history that they can see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yes, it's about women and women's rights and that kind of a thing. And I personally think we should start teaching boys that girls matter as early as possible.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I think we need to do that.
Uh-huh.
But I also think that, again, removing this sort of, I don't know how to frame it except to keep saying wall of text, but removing this sort of, I'm someone's droning at you. This is a more interactive approach. We talk a lot about boys and how they drop off from being good readers around fourth grade or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much that they drop off. It's that I've noticed, because I have 2 sons, around that age is when they start to really get heavily into comics, into video games, that kind of thing. So one of the things I wanted to do with this was make it so that if you are saying to the boy in your house who has 20 minutes of reading to do as part of his assignment, here, read this. At least I'll know you're learning something.
Mm-hmm.
It was something he would want to read and be curious about the images he saw. I wanted it to be something girls would look at and be able to see themselves. I wanted everyone to be able to see themselves represented and know that history is their story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and at the end, I mean, you do talk about entertainers, women in the entertainment field, which was kind of surprising to me when I was reading through it, because it doesn't seem to fit. But is that your way of reaching out to, you know, the younger readers?
Well, it's 2 things. It's reaching out to younger readers, and also a reminder that what we think of as women's rights has got a much more broad implication than we sometimes think of. We know that, for instance, NBA players are multimillionaires. Mm-hmm. WNBA players make less than half of what they do. We know that when we're talking about soccer players, for instance, even though the women's teams win more, they get paid less. And so that fight for equality hasn't stopped. It's in different industries now, maybe, right? Winning the right to vote is not the end of the fight for rights. Winning the right to have accommodations, to be able to work and not be sexually harassed, all of these things are steps. They're not the final end, the final goal. And so when we're talking about entertainment, we're talking about all of these things, we also have to remember that the girls who dream of being on those stages, who dream of working in that world, you know, even if you don't want to be Beyonce, but you want to be one of Beyonce's background dancers, or you want to be a costume designer or whatever, you should be paid fairly in that world. You should absolutely be able to earn and be respected and be safe in your workplace.
Yes, excellent, excellent point. And you do, at the end, do cover a lot of different areas. So I could see a teacher doing one page per lesson, because there is so much to talk about and discuss in there. Was that part of too what you wanted to do, was to create discussion?
Yes, I would hope both for the parents and teachers, because I know that there are some parents who homeschool, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to be able to look at this page, to be able to say, let's look up this person, let's look up the time they were living in, let's look up what was happening in the world around them. A thing I point out sometimes is that, even though we don't think of it this way, Martin Luther King and Anne Frank were born the same year.
Oh my gosh, I never thought about that either. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. That is amazing.
So when you're looking at something like this and you're looking at the dates and the times, I want people to say, oh, what else was going on that year?
Mm-hmm.
What was happening not just in the U.S. or in the UK, but what was happening in Mexico, what was happening here, what was happening there, and how do these things tie together? What were we all doing socially in different communities, and what impact were we having on each other? Because we tend to think of the world somehow as this weirdly siloed thing, right? So like, you'll see the argument sometimes, oh, well, because of Jim Crow, this TV show set in the 1940s in New York doesn't have black people, because there wouldn't have been black people because of Jim Crow. And then you have to explain, like, the Harlem Renaissance.
Right.
And Harlem are happening in New York in the 1940s.
Yes.
if you're looking at, you know, an image of Queen Elizabeth and you're like, well, there wouldn't have been any black people in medieval Europe. Really, where'd that brazier come from? Where'd the fur come from? Where'd the gold? Where'd the satin? You know, because you have to start having that conversation and put, sort of pushing back. And I want parents to be able to sit down and say, who would have been there? What was going on?
Mm-hmm.
And right? How did this get here?
And how important is it for them to learn not to just accept what they read?
I want people to think critically. I want kids to be able to ask themselves what media is showing them.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think there was ever a point in history where the world was all one race, all one culture, that's not true. If you ever think these different cultures didn't interact, that's not true. You know, we for years thought of the Amazons as a myth. And then we find out that they found them, but they decided they were men because they were buried with weapons.
So the Amazon, the Amazons that we think of as, well, Wonder Woman, obviously. But
right,
yeah.
We think of it as Wonder Woman, and it's Sarmutians and... Mm-hmm. You know, the Dahomey Amazons, like, women always fought. We know that the world that exists now, we got here somehow, but we didn't get here just because one group got us here. It wasn't all men or even close. Women are 50% of the population.
Exactly.
50% of history, too.
You'd think you'd see it in a book, but it's not necessarily in our history book, is it? Not at all. So you got to know, I'm assuming you learned a lot when you were doing this research about women that you hadn't heard of before. Were there some that became like your favorites?
I went through this whole period, especially when I got to the movements around orphan children.
Ah.
And I started to realize, looking at, you know, the Jewish partisans, orphan children after the World War, all of these things, that there were a lot of quiet places where women really made a difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't see Sophie Scholl. We don't see the settlement movement or any of these other things. Like, I mean, you hear about Jane Addams and Hull House, but you don't necessarily realize how many things women impacted. But social services, as we know it, is really the work of women. We wouldn't have a social services system. We didn't have a social services system until women started to step up, women with a little bit more money, a little bit more resources started to step up and say, well, we've got to open a place that's safe. We've got to open some place for poor families and their children to go. We have to provide food and housing and health care. And I know that people will, you know, later say, well, why couldn't this bootstrap thing, my ancestors came here and they picked themselves up, but they probably didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what happened is they probably got help from people who were already here. That's how communities work. That's how healthy societies work. And so I was really fascinated to realize how many very mundane things, right, that we think of as normal now are things that happened because a woman fought for them. And I mean, things as mundane as how we end up with food stamp programs. All of that surplus food was going to waste before food stamps. So they come up with WIC and other programs to feed people, but that's because farmers who otherwise were going broke, right? They have food, but no one to sell it to.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a supplemental program that only runs towards poor people. It's a supplemental program that bolsters farms. It's the biggest form of farm aid. Well, you get that because Shirley Chisholm looks at the books and says, well, this is a problem. We have hungry people here and food surplus here. Let's get the food surplus to the hungry people.
Common sense. Common sense.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. Well, we run out of time. It's a great conversation. And like I said, Mickey, it's a wonderful book. I hope people go out and, you know, either get it from the library or buy it, give it as a gift to kids, because they're really going to enjoy it. Thank you, Mickey.
Thank you.